electronics in which I not magnetically but electrostatically, just by coupling capacitance between that wire and my sensitive circuit, I can induce a undesired 60 cycle signal. And by the way, one of the things you want to know, let me drop.
Hey, Derek.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
You're talking about the classic telephone ground loop, okay, because the Polycom is hooked up to the phone line.
Okay, that could be part of it. But just by electrostatic coupling, I can create an undesired signal into a sensitive piece of electronics. There's lots of ways you can do it. So the way your electronics is grounded and is something to experiment with, but you might eventually have to do some sniffing. I was about to make a suggestion, and it just went out of my head. Oh, well. There's various ways of troubleshooting this. You've got to change everything step by step in the environment to find out what makes it better or what makes it worse. I know it's not easy. All undesired interference problems, the chain is no stronger than the weakest link. One of the first things I'd recommend is that you put an oscilloscope on the audio line and confirm that the signal you're picking up is truly 60 cycles and not a rectified 120 cycles. If so, that's another extremely strong clue. You're calling it hum. For all you know, there's some crazy source of signal of 90 hertz in your environment, and it's not 60 cycles at all. So definitely put an oscilloscope on it, confirm the waveform shape, confirm the frequency. That'll give you some strong clues. These are some of the things I would begin doing to trace this one down, as I see it, Glenn. Gary. W2MIT, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, some of these phones have an AC power pack that operates them. I don't know if he's walked around the room with the phone, but it may have battery backup. I would disconnect the AC power supply and see if it still happens on the battery backup, if it has that. That's one way of doing it. I've done that type of troubleshooting, and it's probably more likely what Eric said, the ground hum problem with telephones when you hook them up with a varying ground.
If it is a ground hum problem, what's the easiest way of solving that one, John?
First of all, he's talking about a Polycom, which is designed to be on the phone line. And actually it has some hum rejection stuff in it. So you get a lousy phone line, you call a phone company and they fix it.
That's a beautiful suggestion. John, I think you had another suggestion. Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, just what Eric had mentioned, because we don't know where that's coming from. It could be on the phone line itself, which you wouldn't hear it on a standard phone, but these high-tech electronic phones are very high in gain, so that could be the other source of the hum.
Yeah, I think you could say that every phone line has 60-cycle hum on it. What's left is to determine how much. Is it 3 dB below the level of tolerance, or is it a nanovolt, a microvolt, a millivolt, and so on? Every phone line has got some hum. Over to you, Gary. W2MIT, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Comment?
Comment.
Go ahead, Gary, first.
Okay, I appreciate all the comments. I have tried some of these steps. This particular unit does not run off of battery. I've had much better experience with the battery-operated Polycoms, which are basically cordless versions of the same high-end conference phone. But this one purports to be even higher-end than those wireless versions, and that's what perplexes me as to how, with the sophisticated filtering they must use in there, why they're letting this through. You have an excellent suggestion about confirming the frequency and the waveform, and I do feel like the hum is being introduced by the phone line because I don't hear it when the phone line's disconnected, but then again, I'm not sure whether that's because the basic amplification electronics cut out when it realizes there's no phone line attached. The thing is useless when there's no phone line attached anyway. But if the hum is being introduced by its connection to the analog phone line, then I'm wondering if there's anything under my control, instead of relying on the phone company, that I could do to eliminate the, like you say, the ground loop. And it sounds like there's a couple more comments in there.
Any comments?
Yep.
Okay, Glenn, you want to make a comment? KC2QIQ, go ahead.
Should we wait for a drop?
You got it, Glenn.
Okay, just my comment was that, you know, typically with these kinds of things in phone lines, yes, you're right that 60 cycles is on phone lines, but typically it's in common mode. And with the types of filters that most of these phones have, the common mode interference is generally not a problem, because what's basically on one side is on the other side, so they kind of cancel each other out inside the phone. And with a little bit of common mode filtering inside the phone, it's easily taken care of. And in most cases, that's true. But the problem is if you're connecting up to a phone line and you're hearing a strong hum in the background, chances are, yes, it is coming from the phone line. And two is that that's something that the phone line, or the phone company, excuse me, the provider has to fix in that line, because somewhere they have something either grounded or not grounded in a way that they're winding up with differential noise, which can really be a problem. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment. Okay, fine, Glenn. We've got 10 people saying comment. The next person I recognized from before was Paul. WS2N, go ahead.
Okay, let me see if I have it.
You've got it, Paul.
Gary has a three-pronged plug on that thing. I wonder if it's similar to what I have with my TV. Big grounding problem. And using our cable vision, you know, we have a phone and a TV and all, computer. But there was a 60-cycle hum on there that we confirmed with the, I have an oscilloscope. But, you know, temporarily get rid of it anyway. What they did is, just to see if you could do it, you have a three-prong plug, they eliminated that grounding plug. The hum was coming through the cable vision, through the TV, and using my TV's ground connection to go back, and the TV would hum. I wonder if that might be the case with this, someone that has a three-prong plug. Because if it does, then you could just put one of those adapters in temporarily just to see. And then you only have the two, you know, the neutral and the hot, and, you know, put in and without the ground. And then if you don't hear it, you could say, okay. And then you could really definitely call the phone company and tell them, look, your ground is, you know, it's definitely coming through your phone. When I eliminate my ground on this three-prong plug, that solves the problem. But I don't know. It might have a two-prong plug. Then it's just a guess. Back to you, Dick.
Eric? Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, that's not exactly what's going to be my question to him. Was, because Polycom makes their wall was with a ground plug. And typically, if you use a ground lifter, I mean, we do it in broadcasting all the time. You go to a stage, you put a stage box on, and you get a lot of hum. We actually put little pushes in to lift the ground, even though we use a balanced line. But that's typically the trick. But you can get local ground loops within the phone line. It face it every day. And there's actually a specification that the phone company has, because there is a minimum value, and if they exceed that value, actually the phone people have this little pet that tells them, and, you call them up and say, I've got a ground loop problem here, and they'll come and fix it.
Take the TY coming.
Okay, good suggestion. So the ground lifter, you're eliminating the safety ground. Got to be a little bit careful on how you do that. All right, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I had a situation, we had a broken line here, and if you picked up the phone, you didn't get the dial tone, but you surely could hear that hum in the background. Now, after they fixed the lines and all, I said to myself, I wonder, what does that hum still, that 60 cycle still present? I would, remember, this is twisted, I have a regular landline, twisted wire. So what I did is, I dial like, one, just to kill the dial tone. You still can hear, if you listen carefully, that 60 cycle on there. It seems to be present no matter what with the twisted wire, Dick. Even when the phone is working normally, over.
Comment.
Yeah, I agree with that one. That every phone line has got some 60 cycle hum on it. It may be a microvolt, it may be a millivolt, it may be a half a volt. And a function of where that wire goes, how it's grounded, how well it's isolated by way of common mode versus differential mode, and so on. John, KC2, WGB, go right ahead.
One thing they may want to look at, I'm sure they've tried it in other phone jacks, but make sure the tip and ring is not reversed, because the older phones can take it. The newer phones will develop a hum because the common mode is the same, but the other mode is not. It's different on each leg. So that's something to look at, is make sure the tip and ring lines are not reversed.
By the way, Polycom has a balanced input and it's isolated.
Okay, John. I suspect it's going to take quite a bit of effort to isolate this one. But as you do go through the procedure, I think there's a lot of interest in your particular subject. I'd like you to come back and tell us what you find, whether it be successful or not successful. W2MIT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, will do. Excellent, excellent suggestions. I'm going to try that ground lifting trick, and I'll certainly check the tip ring reversal. It's an easy thing for me to check, although I understand Eric's comment as well. And I'll try to come back and report my success or failure with the whole thing. So thanks again, guys. Really appreciate it. K2RIW and the TechNet. This is W2MIT.
Okay, the next person on our list, I'm going to give one more call because he didn't respond before. Joe, W2RYY, are you there?
Really difficult to get in by internet. Yes, I am here.
Okay, we're hearing you. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
again to Jim. I had to comment to the previous subject.
John, I think you said you had a question. Oh, no, Eric is the next person on the list. KE2J, go right ahead with your question, John. Eric.
All right, Dick. I got to get this thing out of no PO mode. That stuff is on the input. Anyway, I was wondering, we were having a discussion, I think it was yesterday, and would you be so kind to explain the principle in which RF and magnetism work in a circulator? K2RIW, K2J.
Yep. The most general exception to the law of reciprocity is gyrotropy. I know what that sounds like. Unfortunately, there's a degree of truth in that. When you take a material like yttrium iron garnet, it's a ferrite-like material that's used for making yeek filters, and also it's one of the materials used for making circulators. You take a what looks like a small hockey puck of this material. You sandwich it with a strip line that looks like a Y-shaped circuit, where you've got a input connector every 120 degrees around the clock, a total of three input connectors. And when you now take this material, which is in the near field of the microstrip circuit, and you add a biasing magnetic field, there is a permanent magnet sandwiched with the ferrite material, with the Y-shaped printed circuit. And you now have a magnetic material with bias, which has some plasma-like characteristics. The bottom line is that what you desire is for the signal that you put into port number one, let me call it the 730 port. You're applying a signal at port number one at 730 on the clock. You want that energy to come out at port number two, which is at 12 o'clock. You want it to not come out of port number three, which is at 4:30. I chose those numbers because they're approximately 120 degrees apart on the clock. In other words, you're trying to create what's called circular propagation. Into one, out of two, into two, out of three, into three, out of one, but not in the reverse direction. What really happens is that
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The fancy ferrite yeek-like material with the biasing magnetic field violates reciprocity. By that I mean, if you study internally what's going on, the velocity of propagation clockwise and the velocity of propagation counterclockwise are not the same. Therefore, you can set it up in such a way that all the signals into port one, some of the signal goes in the clockwise manner, some of the signal goes in the counterclockwise manner, because you carefully set up the differential velocities by way of the magnitude of the magnetic field and the other geometries you've done to set this thing up. The clockwise and counterclockwise signal come out in phase at port number two and out of phase at port number three. So you get this crazy kind of propagation into one, out of two, into two, out of three, and so on. When you set it up such that you put a termination on port number three, any of the energy that comes into port number one and you desire to come out to port number two, port number one could be your transmitter, port number two could be your antenna. All of the energy coming back from the antenna, whether it be standing wave ratio energy or undesired energy coming down the antenna in the near frequency region, all the energy coming down the antenna will go into port number three. If port number three is your receiver and port number one is your transmitter, you could, in some cases, use this as an isolating device where you've kept the transmitter and receiver isolated from each other, even though they're connected to a common antenna. And all the signals flow in the desired direction, and none of the signals flow in the undesired direction. That's one of many ways you can use a circulator slash isolator. In many cases, what's called an isolator is merely a circulator with a terminating resistor on one of the ports. Let me drop. What's unique about, what's very interesting about most circulators is that You may desire a circulator because you're a ham radio operator in the 10.368 gigahertz band. But the only one you can buy in a particular flea market is tuned to 11 gigahertz. And you want it to work at 10.368 gigahertz. Once you realize that there's a linear relationship between the magnetic field strength and the frequency at which it's tuned, you can adjust for that. If I wanted to move it up in frequency, I would put some refrigerator magnets on there to increase the magnetic field. If I wanted to go down in frequency, I put refrigerator magnets on there in the opposite polarity to decrease the field. So you can carefully tune within small frequency region. You can carefully tune an isolator. And in some cases, you can take a mediocre isolator that's got 15 or 20 dB of directivity. And at your particular favorite frequency, you may be able to scoot that up to 40 or 50 dB of directivity. I've been involved in some of those operations. So that's part of what's going on. Maybe that helps a little bit, Eric. Do you think they're going to understand that one? KE2EJ, K2RAW in the Tech Night.
Thank you for that, Dick. You did a much better job of explaining it than I was attempting to. Actually, it's just as a matter of information. I mean, I use them to combine multiple microwave transmitters and receivers and separate them, and they come in the form of waveguides. They look like keys, so to speak. But in the repeaters and at the repeater site, we use them to try and minimize the interaction between transmitters. And that includes transmitters and antennas, and that includes to try and minimize the interaction that gives us intermod. So, John, there's a much better answer than I gave you. K2RIW, KE2J.
Yeah, one further thing that some people don't understand is that is when you choose a nice high building on a nice high piece of land, like say, for instance, the Glen Oak site, we just happen to have because it is so desirable for two-way radio communication, for instance, it's such a desirable site. You might have 50 separate clients all on that same building. And many of them have their individual stick antennas all radiating signals like crazy. One of the things that's not easy to understand is that an FM transmitter, the final stage will give you maximum efficiency if it's running Class C. That's the good news. Class C is a very nonlinear mode of operation as far as undesired products approaching that particular amplifier. So therefore, you may be doing a beautiful job of transmitting 146.85 megacycles out of your transmitter into your antenna. And 10 feet away is somebody else's transmitter, 15 megacycles away. And the signal coming out of his antenna, by all the laws of propagation, must be hitting your antenna. And because you're so darn close, it's a potent signal. That signal 15 megacycles higher comes roaring down your antenna and goes into your transmitter final stage backwards. Because the final stage of a Class C transmitter is the most nonlinear thing in the world when signals are fed back into it. It is a beautiful mixer. For that undesired signal coming back in there, combined with the desired signal, it's going to find all possible combinations. The second harmonic of one and the third harmonic of the other, and so on. It's going to find all kinds of possible combinations in this high-level mixer. That final stage will generate those other signals. Those other signals it's generating, and there's going to be a whole Christmas tree of them. If you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, some of them are going to fall on somebody else's input frequency that's on that building. And when that happens,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
And when that happens, those guys are going to be jammed and they're going to be damn unhappy. Therefore, you have to assure that the final stage of your transmitter has nothing in it but your desired frequency and nothing else. By way of the duplexing filter and its partial sharp filtering skirts, that helps. But still, when you're in a busy environment, a hell of a lot of other signals are coming down your antenna, even though you think you're transmitting. You have to stop that from happening. By putting a circulator between your transmitter and the duplexing filter, that's one place you can put it. It's a very desirable, that's the best place to put it. You make sure that anything that wants to come back into your transmitter goes into the third port, the terminated port of your circulator. Because the circulator is going to have something like a half a dB of insertion loss, and because somebody has always been sent to the top of that building because a client is complaining, I'm not getting enough range, and the guy looks at the spec sheet, and that particular transmitter is supposed to put out 50 watts, and it's putting out 45 watts. And he says, gee, I've tweaked, and I can't get more than 45 watts out of the transmitter. By the way, the difference between 40 watts and 50 watts is a small fraction of a dB, and 99% of the time it's got nothing to do with that particular client. But the guy who's sent up there to do service, he's looking at the spec sheet, it's supposed to put out 50, he can't make 50. He doesn't want to go through all the rigmarole of changing out that transmitter. Too much physical labor. He does a whole bunch of experiments, and he finds out that if he eliminates the circulator that had a half a dB of insertion loss, he's now making 49.99 watts coming out. He calls it 50, and he walks away. You let a guy who's untrained do that. He removes the circulator from one of the 50 transmitters that are on the top of that building. The other 49 people are in terrible peril because of what he did. And he doesn't have the right training to know he better not do that or he's going to be shot.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
WB2HWW with a comment on this subject?
How we recognize he's going to be shot at sunrise by a whole group of 49 people that are damn happy at him. Damn unhappy at him. You have to make sure that any of the people that are given access to a site like that have been taught by way of their training, you will never eliminate a circulator on anybody's transmitter for any reason unless you're replacing it with one with higher performance capability. Otherwise, you're going to kill a hell of a lot of other hardware up there. This cycle has been going on for years, and it creates a hell of a lot of grief, and it sometimes takes months to find out who did it. And by then, that guy is no longer an employee, and you start the cycle all over again with untrained people. Eric, I wonder how often you've run into something like that. Howie, stand by a minute. Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And KC2QIQ with the comments after that, Dick.
Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, considering I'm really not in the two-way radio business, I've seen it too often. And, Billy and I went through all the stuff we're looking at it to make sure that they're in place. And at the site, when you finally put the right devices back, most of the problems go away. But it's something that seems to happen a lot. I mean, you know, if you've got something that's a half a dB of insertion loss, that can add up to a lot of watts in terms of transmitted output power. Dick?
Yeah, half a dB will take a 100-watt transmitter down to 89 watts. Yes, you've lost 11 watts. That looks like a lot. Half a dB when it comes to real receiver sensitivity of those clients, which is 1/12 of one S unit on a well-calibrated S meter of a good ham radio receiver. It really is a minor perturbation. If you think that's the cause of action of improper operation of your two-way radio business, I guarantee 97% of the time that ain't it. And so the exact number of watts you put output, to accept the vulnerability of removing a circulator just to meet somebody's cockamamie specification sheet as to what that particular transmitter is supposed to put out. It's really a misunderstanding of the physics involved. Howie, go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW and TechNet.
All right, couple of comments here. Comment number one. A circulator is a nonlinear device, so you have to have a harmonic filter called an IM panel, intermodulation panel. It has a circulator, a dummy load, and a harmonic filter, which is set for twice your frequency. And a lot of times when a guy goes up to a site, the guy checks it out. He should check out the harmonic filter. Yeah, you may lose something through the IM panel, but it could be a problem where the filter isn't set right. It could be a defective. A good IM panel, depending on if it's a single section or a two section, a single section should give you anywhere between 3/10 to 4/10 of a dB loss. And a dual section should be 1 dB of loss. And obviously you want to check, you know, everything else. Another reason why you want to use a circulator is that you want the output of your amplifier, your Class A amplifier, to go into a nice load. Remember, when you go into duplexes and into the antenna system, you could have some reflections. So you want your PA to always see a you know, -50, -40 dB return loss, a very nice return loss, regardless of what's happening at the end. But one thing you need to make sure is that you have a harmonic filter on the output of the circulator, and number two, Dick, at most sites, I've been involved in managing a site here or two in my lifetime, is in the contract, in the lease agreement, it says that all people or all transmitters will have a circulator, and if you're caught without a circulator, it's grounds for being kicked off the site. Go ahead, Dick.
In some cases, that's justified. Now, when it comes to passive intermodulation distortion, another very poorly understood, highly controversial subject, you take, for instance, one of the worst environments I can think of is a cellular telephone transmitting site. There you've got a large number of carriers simultaneously being generated by the cell site hardware itself. And as such, it's not even somebody else's hardware, it's their own hardware that can give them a hell of a lot of grief. As such, they've got a specification that is a real stiff one, and that is every connector, every cable, every antenna, everything from the cabinet of the transmitter in the enclosure, everything toward the antenna downrange, the lightning protector, everything else, must meet a PIM spec that would drive you crazy. For a pair of 20-watt signals, all intermodulation distortion must be 150 decibels down. The highest performance spectrum analyzer you can buy only has 100 dB of dynamic range on the screen. And here's a specification you got to meet. That's 150 dB weaker than each of those 20-watt transmitters. It takes very special equipment to be able to make the measurement. All you've got to do is have the silver plating wiped off on your 7/16 connector, your DIN connector, because it's been inserted so many times in cross-threaded ones, and somebody's got dissimilar metals touching each other because he scraped away the, unintentionally scraped away the some of the coatings that's there, and that particular connector can fail that specification. The reason I'm giving you this info, let me drop, is to say the most linear thing you can think of, a jumper cable, a passive cable with a piece of coaxial connector on it, and a very well-designed antenna. Each of those things are capable and frequently do fail a passive intermodulation distortion test of the requirement for a cell site. So now when you talk about a circulator, can it fail that spec? Oh, verily, easily. But now, how does the circulator do that? Let me give you a ridiculous example. If I took a circulator that's rated for 10 watts, and I connect it to a 20-watt transmitter, my goodness, are you going to get nonlinearity? I'm saturating the darn thing. Conversely, if I've got a 50-watt transmitter, and I properly designed the circulator that it is capable of handling 500 watts, and I'm using it at 50 watts, the amount of intermodulation distortion it makes is going to be tremendously suppressed by comparison. So now you're between a rock and a hard place. Do I invest a whole lot of dollars in making a great big circulator that can tolerate high power? Or do I invest a medium number of dollars and put filters after it to eliminate second harmonics? Well, that's some of the trade-offs that you do as a designer. Everything in this world has a degree of nonlinearity. And you would never believe it, and I've done it myself. When you look for that PIM spec, 150 dB down, for a cell site, there is not one single piece of braided cable, per se, on planet Earth that can meet that specification. The individual strands of that braided cable rubbing against each other, even if you're not flexing it, will fail that specification. When you have the right kind of equipment that can meet that requirement, and you set those two signals into an antenna, you've got a perfectly good connector and antenna, and you put those two signals on it, and connected to those two antennas is this PIM requirement, is this PIM equipment capable of seeing 150 dB down, and you stand in front of an antenna 20 feet away.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Now let me reword that. You stand in front of an antenna 10 feet away, and you jiggle the change in your...
Let it recycle.
I didn't hear what you said, Eric. Okay, I'll let it recycle. You set up that PIM equipment with two 20-watt signals, into an antenna at a UHF frequency. You stand in front of that antenna 10 or 20 feet away, and you jiggle the change in your pocket. An extremely weak signal that gets to those quarters and dimes and pennies in your pocket. And they're touching each other, metal-to-metal contact, as you jiggle the change. They are making passive intermodulation distortion that gets re-radiated back into space, picked up on that antenna, and displayed on the PIM measuring equipment. You will fail that spec by 30 dB just by jiggling the change in your pocket 20 feet away. Once you realize how sensitive that requirement is, picture having a rusty nail on a cell site tower or a hose clamp that's making metal-to-metal contact on something it shouldn't because it broke through the paint, if you know what I mean. You got to be very careful. So everything makes distortion. The only thing left to discuss is how much and how sensitive is your equipment to measure it. But you get a kick out of some of that. I'll admit it's not easy to understand the first time you hear it. Maybe you'll be hearing it a few more times if I don't get kicked off here. KC2QIQ, I know you want to make a comment, Jen. I call it KQRIW in the segment.
Get on a comment after, Dick.
And wait a couple of seconds after the beep, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I just want to make a comment about the magnet and the circulator. It's a very interesting way how the circulator works with the magnet. That it works very, very similar to creating a BH offset curve, very similar to like slipping the magnet in the air gap of an inductor. You're basically polarizing the strip line. So now what's happening is instead of the BH curve on a normal, typical piece of, let's say, like doroid, with a ground plane underneath it swinging through zero all the time, now with the added ceramic and the magnet, now the BH curve is no longer starting at zero. It's starting at an offset, and it's polarized plus to minus. So now what's interesting is, depending on which side is the north and the south side of the magnet with respect to the strip line, what it's basically doing is offsetting the initial BH curve in one direction. So now as it goes from the first port to the second port, you're in the positive direction. The reason that there's no reciprocity is because in the reverse direction, in the other way, the signal would be bucking below the flux line and it would be canceled. Very, very interesting how that works, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
B2HWW, another comment on this matter?
Yeah, I've got a little problem with what you just said, Glenn. In the case of a inductor that's being used as the smoothing choke in a power supply, where I want the inductor to have a certain amount of inductance so that it has a certain amount of filtering capability, I want inductor reactance between C1 and C2 of my pi filter network, of my power supply. I want inductance, therefore I don't want a saturated inductor, but I have to put current through it, otherwise it's not a power supply. By biasing it in the way you describe, works beautifully. That's for a one-direction flow of current of a circuit that's acting like an inductor to do inductor reactance to do filtering. When you put RF energy into a circulator, it is a sine wave with two polarities, positive and negative. It's a sine wave going through both polarities, and therefore the biasing example you gave is not quite what's going on. You get down to the molecular level of Yig material, and you put a biasing magnetic field and an RF current, an RF signal simultaneously. Precession is taking place. What is precession? Let me drop. When you spin your top, your ordinary toy top, at the end of its life, before it settles down to the floor, you see it move in a very characteristic manner. It wobbles in a funny way. That's called precession. At the molecular level, Yig material is doing that. And if you set as you make the magnetic field stronger, the rate at which it precesses is faster. That's the reason why a Yig filter has a relationship between what frequency it filters and what magnetic field you put into the Yig filter. It's a direct one-to-one relationship down to 0 hertz and 0 magnetic field, even though it doesn't operate there, all the way up to the highest frequency. If your particular Yig filter is running at 2 gigahertz with a particular strength of magnetic field, and you exactly double the strength of the magnetic field, instead of it passing 1 gigahertz, it'll pass exactly 2 gigahertz. You're making that precession operate at the 2 gigahertz level. That's how the cross-coupling takes place between the input coil and the output coil of the Higgs filter. Because those two coils are orthogonal to each other, they normally don't couple. They only couple through the Higgs material by way of the precession, and the rate of the precession determines what frequency goes through. Believe it or not, the Higgs material that's used in a circulator has some of that characteristic. And it's part of the mechanism by which it has a different velocity of propagation clockwise versus counterclockwise. So there's a degree of similarity in your biased gap fixed magnetic circuit. But when it comes to RF operation, there's another phenomenon going on, and I think the precession is the one that's dominating. I wonder if that makes some sense, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, by the way, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
In the high-powered VHF television transmitted, we use circulators as interstage coupling devices with big terminating resistors on port number 3. It's a way of isolating between the plate of one stage and the grid of the input of the next stage.
And that gives you much greater linearity, less group delay distortion, and therefore that beautiful bandwidth of television you're trying to transmit doesn't get distorted by funny resonances at your passband. It presents a more pure 50-ohm load to each one of those stages. Is that approximately what's taking place, Eric?
That's precisely what's taking place. And by the way, they're rather large devices because they handle a lot of power.
And you have reason to believe, Eric, that as you make the ferrite device larger and larger, it tolerates greater and greater power and gives you less and less non-linearity at the particular power level you're operating on. I wonder if you've seen... I wonder if you've seen phenomena along those lines, Eric, go ahead.
Yes, I have, actually. A couple of the guys from the transmitter manufacturers, there's actually different sizes, different interstages, and they would actually set them up for a minimum group delay and... Linearity is just amazing. The bigger ones work better than the smaller ones.
2HW,
comment in this matter?
Yeah, can I give a chance for my rebuttal?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, very good. It was just that the point that I was making out, I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying about the precession. It's actually agreeing with it, because what I'm pointing out is that if you take a piece of regular strip line material, as a toroid, take it, think of anything, and it's got a velocity factor. And when you set up the impedance along a strip line, whether it's 50 ohms, you know, depending on the thickness of the material and the width of the line, and then you run a length of it between two connectors, let's say, in this particular case, there's a velocity factor, the speed of the signal moving down that signal. Now, what happens when you start taking that, and what's actually causing the velocity factor? It's the dielectric constant between the center lead and that ground plane. Now, if we take that velocity factor and we put an offset to it, that offset initially in a plain piece of coax or strip line is going to be going through zero. Now let's offset it, and let's talk about precession, what's actually going on here. If you take it off zero and put it into another quadrant, in other words, if you look at your B sub M curve versus H, and you give it a negative offset, so now it's no longer on zero into one direction, now you've basically destroyed reciprocity. Because what's happening is now you're elevated to a positive H field that's going to force the signal in one direction, because the other direction now is going to look like an absolutely rotten match, because in the other direction where you have positive H, you're going through zero in the other direction where there's no bias anymore. Does that make more sense? That's causing that precession for it to follow one direction. And of course, as the field gets stronger and you have more amplitude that you're putting in there, you're adding more and more bias to hold it and ensure that it's off-centered. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I got a question for you, Glenn. Would the waveform where you're getting a partial saturation in one direction and not in the other direction because of the biasing of the magnetic field, would that resultant waveform no longer be a pure sine wave? If it's true, if it's no longer a pure sine wave, boy, are you making harmonics. Over to you, Glenn.
You need a harmonic filter.
Okay, I think I've got it here. Yeah, precisely, Dick, because, as I said, you know, it's right now, if you look at the load line of linear load, you're going to have an intrinsic limit. So as you're putting that bias from the magnet in one direction, and you draw the new load line, you actually basically offset. If the signal becomes too large, now you're going to be going out of the range of the new H field, because you have to draw a new load line, because the load line normally in a strip line or a coax is going through the middle. You had the bias, you put it off on one side, now it's off in one direction, the velocity factor in that direction is fixed, and then you have a reverse, the velocity factor in the other direction is just, and the impedance going the other way is horrible. So if you go outside the range of that magnetic field where it's offsetting H, you go in the other direction, it's going to be non-sinusoidal, distortion, and all kinds of hell will break loose. And I guess maybe a harmonic filter will help, but if you do it too much, I would imagine that you'd even overpower that. K2RIW, KC2.
How about you, B2HWW?
I've got to disagree with you, Glenn. The velocity of a transmission line, when you're building strip line and microstrip, because we build it out of conductive and dielectric materials, the dielectric constant is a big factor, a velocity factor. 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant is the new velocity factor, or the velocity factor variation. We all forget about magnetic effects. In the case of the ferrite going on in the circulator, the strip line portion of a circulator, I've got simultaneous dielectric materials and simultaneous magnetic materials. The magnetic materials also affect the velocity of propagation. When I've got that particular desired combination of magnetics and dielectrics plus biasing with this precession phenomena going on, the net result is that from left to right I get one velocity of propagation, from right to left I get a brand new velocity of propagation. It violates reciprocity. It's called gyrotropy. Gyrotropy does not use saturation of the magnetic field as its primary method of operation. The rate of precession is a function of the magnetic field. That is what's the mechanism by which you get these different velocities of propagation. The bottom line is that circulator has one velocity of propagation clockwise, another one counterclockwise. You carefully tune it to tune out some ports and favor others. You therefore get the isolation you want by using this non-reciprocity in a desirable manner. I think saturation of a circulator is an extremely undesirable characteristic. You do not use it. You try very hard to avoid it, because it would, the slightest amount of saturation phenomena as part of the propagation phenomena, in my opinion, would be intolerable. You and I may disagree on this one. I don't think we should carry it too much further right now. You and I will both do a little more research and get to the bottom of it. I know that both Mel and Howie wants to make a further comment. Mel, we've been holding you up for some time. K2KEY, K2RIW, I bet you've used some circulators.
This is K2KEY. Well, I was trying to make a comment earlier when people were asking, you know, about basically a circulator, and I was going to try to make it a little bit simpler. Really, the circulator not only came into use basically because it provided, as you say, in reducing the IMZ product, but it was a secondary advantage that a properly designed circulator provides a matched load at the transmitter output regardless of the SWR of the antenna stick. Over.
Good point. That's one of its very strong uses. That's what Eric was telling us. When I was working with Bell Laboratories way back in the 70s, in order to be super conservative on all the microwave circuits they were building, they were doing the extreme version of what Eric is describing just to make sure that every single one of their stages of their multi-stage amplifier, microwave, mixer, filter assembly was all running in a pure linear zero megahertz to infinite megahertz, seeing exactly 50 ohms resistive. They were putting circulators in between every single stage of the stuff they were building. To them, money was no object. High reliability and high performance is what they were looking for. And they weren't worrying about the fact that each circulator cost X number of dollars, and they threw a whole lot of them in there that some of them were not necessarily needed. So properly used, a circulator will make the stage that's feeding it think it sees a pure 50-ohm load, even though at certain frequencies what's beyond the circulator represents a short circuit or an open circuit. So it's a beautiful normalizer. I mean, the only other way you can get that degree of normalization is to put in a 20 dB pad in between every stage. Now your transmitter will see very close to 50 ohms DC to light, but very few of us have got that much gain to throw away that we can put in 20 dB pads in between all of our stages. If you've got the sophistication to use circulators, you come out way ahead. It's a powerful tool, not very well understood, a little bit on the expensive side, but if you've got the resources and the knowledge to use it, it can do some magic. Go ahead, Howie. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Can you hear me okay, Dick, now?
Hearing you pretty well. Go ahead, Howie, and then I'll pick up Bell right after that. Howie first.
Hey, pretty well. I just want to know if there's any noise on my signal, because I want to make sure we have no antenna damage from the hurricane for the tornadoes. Let me make a couple of comments here. Number one, the reason why, you know, I use circulators. If you have an amplifier, a class amplifier, like a Henry amplifier, which is not the greatest amplifier, if that goes into a circulator and you're going into a duplex or into your station master, Dick, and you have changes in impedances and stuff like that, the amplifier is not going to cause problems and not going to be spurious because it's always looking at a common, at a constant 50-ohm load. And another easy trick that I have for checking circulators is I'll hook up a SiteMaster or a, or let's say, you can even use, I've even used an MFK antenna analyzer, and you take the output of the circulator, you either go, you know, properly terminated, you know, you have the dummy load, the return load on, and you basically either go to a short, to an open, to a load, and you want to make sure that you see no difference in the return loss. That may not give you an exact answer if the circulator is working, because you're not really, you know, you're not doing a dynamic test, you're doing a static test, you're not putting power into it. But if you want to know, you should see almost no difference in return loss. That means if you got a 35 or a 40 dB return loss, and you go from an open to a short, you should see basically no difference. That'll let you know that your circulator is working at that appropriate frequency. The only other comment I can make, Dick, and I've seen this too many times at sites with ham people, they'll use diamonds, they'll use comets, they'll use non-commercial antennas and wonder why they're not going to cause problems at sites. As you say, I am a big thing. I've gone up to the site, and as I'm listening to a signal, somebody, you know, 70, I just take my or my chains in my pocket start dingling, I can hear static on my HD. That's because I'm in a near field of the antenna because there's a lot of RF on top. So you got to be very careful with all kinds of bolts and everything. Just you're taking your keys out and sticking it into the lock to get inside the shack or walk into the repeater room, you can hear a static. You can hear the static. And I've seen at sites where people are on, let's say, you know, not the greatest commercial antennas, you'll have Intermod products. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, yeah, I turned it over to you quite a few times tonight, Joe, and I know for a bunch of reasons the system is not fair and you weren't able to get through. You're on the list for next week if we don't get to you this week. Mel, you want to make a further comment? Go right ahead.
I can make it to all I want to get in. Let's let him get in now. Go ahead, all I want.
To stand by until next week. Mel, you want to make a further comment? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, one more factor about circulators. See, maybe to simplify it a little bit, because I know I'm going to get some comments on it. One of the reasons the circulator became very popular is because you could do something very unique with the with circulators. You can have two transmitters. You take transmitter one into circulator one. You take transmitter two into circulator two. You then put it through a hybrid coupler, and you can use then one antenna. That's the beautiful part, that it will provide that provision. That's where a lot of circulators really began to shine besides the reducing IMD products, etc. But you got to remember, that's what this is capable of doing, Dick. This is basics of the of a circulator, over.
You copy my comments, I'm just curious.
We copied all of them, Howie. Part of what Howie was telling us, and I copied Mel's comment too, was that when you're testing a circulator and you're measuring input impedance to it, while you're modifying the output circuit of the circulator, short, open, and termination, if the circulator has high directivity at your particular frequency, you'll see very little input change the input impedance. It has some degree of similarity to the short, low, load, and open that you use for calibrating a vector network analyzer. So you can measure the directivity of a circulator by the straightforward technique, using it in a forward manner and then reversing it and see how much signal flows through. That's one approach, and you can do that dynamically at real transmitter power. And an assumption that your circulator is sufficiently linear that it doesn't change its characteristics when you put transmitter power through it. And what Howie is saying is that you can measure reflection coefficient at the input port while you measure the output port, make the output port go from short, open, and load, and the degree of change that you see on the input, which usually should be small, is mathematically telling you the degree of isolation you're getting, the degree of directivity. A really mediocre performance circulator has 15 dB of directivity. An extremely good one is 25 or 30. It is possible to buy instrumentation-grade circulators that have 40 and 50 decibels of directivity. And, by the way, when they get that degree of directivity, the insertion loss in the forward mode almost disappears. Doesn't always have to have half a dB of insertion loss. I've seen one go down to a tenth of a dB of insertion loss in the forward mode and 40-some-odd dB of insertion loss in the reverse mode on the exact same frequency. So properly used, they can do magic. For the people, let me drop.
I have a circulator that has about two-tenths of a dB loss, and it runs over $1,000.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Well done, Nick. They tend to be kind of expensive. So circulators are not simple. The fact that you guys are asking the questions and hearing it from people who have sent mail to Mel, maybe you're hearing some of these explanations for the first time, and it doesn't all make sense. That's normal. You're in good company. The first time you hear all this jazz, it sounds too good to be true. How in the world can something have extreme nonlinearity when it comes to the exact same signal flowing forward or in reverse when it goes through the circulator? That's extreme nonlinearity. The signal goes beautifully in one direction with maybe two-tenths of a dB of loss and 40 dB of loss in the reverse direction. It's an RF diode characteristic, if you know what I mean. It's craziness. Very nonlinear. And yet when it comes to two-tone intermodulation distortion test, a very well-designed one can have extreme linearity. Simultaneous linearity in the desired mode and in the reverse direction, what looks like very non-linear performance. In reality, it's very linear. It's just pouring all of the reverse power into the dummy load of the circulator. A good circulator, when you add a dummy load to it, you can call it isolator if you like. And that's what's going on. You're not violating any conservation of energy here. Every single watt and milliwatt that's going around in various directions in the circulator is thoroughly accountable for. You either put it into port number one and it comes out of port number two, or you put it into port number two and it goes into the termination of port number three. So it's all accountable once you understand the theory of operation. It's an extremely useful tool. We probably dwelled on it longer than some people want to tolerate, but it's worth learning about. If you've got the resources to use them, it can allow you to do things you couldn't ordinarily do. And with any further comments, K2RYW in the TechNet.
K2RYW, one final comment. A funny thing once happened.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. I remember a situation in the early days with the repeater, and they were having some very peculiar problems. And the reason it was with the circulator was